In-depth radio. News Talk 610, CKTB.
You're listening to Legal Matters on News Talk 610 CKTV. I'm your host, Steph Vivier, and joining me for this evening's show is Associate Dana Hogarth with Lancaster, Chown & Welch. Good evening, Dana. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for joining this evening. Is this your first time on Legal Matters?
It is.
Awesome.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Welcome. Welcome. And this is an excellent topic, I think one that affects a lot of people, if not themselves directly, but definitely someone in their family. And we're going to be talking about the differences between common law and marriage. I think a lot of people think it's the same exact thing. How does it all work? So I'm excited to dig into that with you tonight.
Yeah, thank you. It is a topic that I've found has there's a lot of misconceptions out there. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to hopefully clear up some of that for your listeners. So it is, and I should say that, you know, my focus will be on the consequences, you know, for separation in the family law context today. So I guess I should start with, you know, what the definition of a common law relationship, because that is very specific in the family law context. I mean, the definition of a married couple is pretty straightforward. You're legally married. But a common law relationship, as defined under the Family Law Act, is one where two people are in a conjugal relationship and have cohabitated continuously for a period of at least 3 years. Or if you have a child together, either biologically or adoptively, you have to be in a relationship of some permanence and cohabitating together. So that can vary situation to situation, usually about a year, but that's not a hard and fast rule. So this is very different than some other definitions of common law that are sort of floating out there. And it is specific to Ontario, I should say, too. There's sort of a patchwork of laws about, you know, property division and so on in throughout the different provinces of Canada. So we're talking about Ontario specifically here. The definition for the CRA is a lot of, you know, is 12 months, right? So people think often we filed our taxes together as common law. We're basically married, but that's not the case here, right? It's also not the same as the definition under the Ontario Disability Support Program Act. So if you receive ODSP benefits, often you can claim your partner who lives with you as a dependent after 3 months with some conditions. Again, that's not the case. So a lot of people who have contact with, you know, CRA, ODSP, et cetera, will have these expectations about what that would mean if they separate. So that's certainly not the case.
Well, let's, you know, that's sort of the thing, Dana, isn't it? That maybe these definitions don't become as important until a relationship breaks down, right?
Exactly.
It's like, you know, a lot of people, oh, we live together, we love each other, we're fine. It truly, as they would say, doesn't matter if we're legally married. It starts when that relationship breaks down, and then there becomes many questions when it comes to property, when it comes to kids. So let's get into that portion of it. When you separate, is it the same? Let's say you pass that 3-year mark as a common law couple. Do you then get to the same rights as a married couple?
So the answer is no. I mean, there's some things that are unaffected depending on the status, married or common law partner, but there are some things that are very different. So the things that are the same, generally speaking, are child support. And that's the same. Child support works basically the same regardless of whether the parents ever live together. But it certainly works the same between cohabitating common law partners and married spouses. And it's, I don't want to say it's straightforward because there's a lot of course, exceptions and specifics to each situation, but it's the automatic right of the child. So in the typical situation where the children spend 60% of the time or more with one parent and 40% of the time or less with the other, it's going to be a calculation based on the parent who spends 40% or less time with the child based on their income. And it's a table, right? It's been, at least the legislation has attempted to standardize child support. Of course, coming to what that income is for child support purposes can be tricky if you have self-employment income, if you have under the table income. So there's a lot, it can get complicated. I don't want to say it's easy, but it's a little more straightforward. And that's the same for any parents. In terms of the date of separation, that's also going to be the same for married people and common law spouses. And that becomes important when you look at property division or even the retroactivity of child and spousal support, because often by the time you're trying to make an agreement, some time has passed since you've separated and you want credit or back payments, sometimes people call them. And the date of separation, it doesn't necessarily mean when you move out. You can be living under the same roof, but living separate and apart, and that can qualify as a separation. So that's something that people don't usually realize. Sometimes it's more straightforward. There's a basement apartment and he or she goes to live there. Sometimes it's not, and that's still okay. That can still be a separation. The court, if you don't agree, the court will look at a number of factors to determine whether you're living separate and apart. Some of those are like if you eat meals together, if you go to functions together. So it can be a really nuanced analysis. But generally speaking, that determination works the same way for common law couples and married spouses.
So I guess I'm hearing there a little bit of advice is that if you do end up in a relationship where you're separating, maybe mark it down when you feel that separation date is, in case it becomes into question. That might be helpful.
Absolutely helpful. Marking it down in writing and make sure that it's communicated. Sometimes I have people coming into my office saying, well, when asked the question, okay, when did you separate? They'll say something like, oh, it's been over for years. Well, okay, but when did you actually have the conversation and break up, more or less? That's, for lack of a better word, it is the breakup date. So both parties have to understand that it's over. But having said that, of course, if you say it's over, you don't need the other person's consent. You can leave a relationship, right? But it still has to be that the other party understands that the relationship is over.
Email, text message, leave a post-it for sure. Like Berger did in Sex and the City, just something to let people know this is not going on anymore.
Exactly. And it can have important consequences down the line, as you know, when you get into property division. And this is, again, for married or unmarried people that live together or have a relationship.
All right. So what I'm hearing there is that when it comes to child support, although it can get complicated, it can get difficult, those things are the same. So really what we're talking about here is probably property division. Is that the real big difference when it comes to actually being married as opposed to common law?
It certainly is. The other thing I should note, though, that is the same, because a lot of people don't realize this either, is spousal support. And this works differently than child support. So this will only kick in after that definition of common law spouse is achieved, that 3 years, or if you have a child, a relationship of some permanence. So both married spouses and common law partners have an equal right to claim spousal support, but it's not automatic in the way that child support is. And it's dependent on a lot of different factors. Some of these are, length of the relationship, each party's income, each party's, capacity to earn an income, because sometimes we're dealing with disabilities or different factors like that. Entitlement can also be on a compensatory basis, which means that it is usually reflective of a difference in roles in the relationship. So if you, if you stayed at home for a long time to take care of the children, for example, that's usually the main situation that captures. It's going to affect your earning potential and your ability to be self-sufficient down the line. It can also, It can also be based on, or your entitlement to spousal support can also be based on just a difference in income, essentially, the means and needs of the spouses upon separation. But really, the goal of spousal support is to bring both parties back on their feet after separation. Although it can be very long-term in duration, or some cases even indefinite, it's meant to, both parties are supposed to stand on their own two feet at the end of the day, if possible, if age appropriately to do so. But that works the same for both common law spouses and married spouses. And it should also note too, if you are married at the time of separation, but you live together ahead of time, the date of cohabitation is where you will start when you look at spousal support calculations. So if you're living together for 10 years or whatever it is before you get married, you separate a year after marriage, we're still looking at an 11-year relationship when we do that calculation. But a lot of factors go into that calculation. We use software because there are different ranges, and it really isn't as straightforward as child support. but it's the same whether you're common law partners or married spouses upon separation.
So that's something the court would decide. You would get your assistance from your legal advice, Lancaster, Town and Welch, going to help you out to say, this is what we've seen, this is what we think you're entitled to, and then a judge decides?
A judge, yeah. If you end up in court, a judge would decide, but it can also be a part of a separation agreement. So if you don't, you know, if you're able to negotiate the terms of the separation, then you don't need to go to court. Or often if you're already in court, you can, you can come up with a settlement that, you know, as long as you both agree to it. But usually we're always guided by what would a judge say at the end of the day. That's usually what drives settlement, whether it's a separation agreement or a settlement during court.
All right. Well, we'll give you a chance to get a little bit of water there as we take a quick break here on Legal Matters. You're listening to Legal Matters on News Talk 610 CKTV, speaking with Associate Dana Hogarth from Lancaster, Chown and Welch. Back with more in just a moment. Back here on Legal Matters, News Talk 610, CKTV, Lancaster, Chown and Welch Associate Dana Hogarth joins me this evening. And we're talking the differences between common law marriage and marriage. And Dana, you've done a great job at outlining the similarities. And there are quite a few similarities. I guess it really comes down to the biggest difference is that property division piece. And this is one that can get, you know, contentious with people because, you know, when relationships break up, there are bad feelings and interesting ways to take it out on one another sometimes.
Absolutely.
Come up. I'm sure you see that all the time. So what are those differences if you're in a common law relationship when it comes to property division?
Yeah, so I mean, the difference is pretty dramatic. I guess first I can talk about what the routine is for married spouses upon separation. So for division of property, and again, this is in Ontario, there's different approaches in different provinces, but in Ontario, there is an automatic entitlement to an equalization of net family property. So this is sort of an overall calculation, and the aim of it is really to equalize or divide the growth that results financially from the marriage. You know, it can be a little bit counterintuitive because a lot of people think that, okay, we just divide, we divide the house, we divide the account. And sometimes after you do this overall calculation, that's practically speaking how it's achieved. But first we have to do this overall calculation to look at, you know, what is the overall growth for each party over the course of the marriage. So how you do that in broad terms, and again, there can be different, you know, this can get very technical depending on what assets and liabilities we're talking about here. But for each spouse, you calculate their net worth at the time of separation, so their assets minus their debts, and then you subtract from that their net worth on the date of marriage, when you entered into the marriage. So again, assets minus debts. And then when you come to the end of that, you'll have a number for spouse A and a number for spouse B. So say, for example, spouse A has $200,000 in net family property. Spouse B has $60,000. Or sorry, say, for example, $80,000, because that's the example I calculated. You're really, so the spouse with more will make a payment to the other for half the difference. So if we're working for that $200,000 and $80,000 example, $60,000 then gets transferred to spouse B, who has, you know, less net worth at the end of the day. And the overall concept, as you can sort of tell, it's giving credit to both parties for whatever they contributed in the marriage. It's not trying to tease apart what, you know, how much did they pay towards the mortgage? How much did they bring in? At different points during the marriage, it's looking at them as equal partners in this, you know, this enterprise. So, and this is an automatic entitlement. Sometimes, I mean, there are limited exceptions to where this wouldn't apply to married spouses that are separating, but they're very, very limited exceptions. It really, the bar is very high. You have to reach a level of, it's called, the standard is unconscionability. So most of the time this applies. There's also special status for married spouses for the matrimonial home. So this is the home that the parties would reside in or share together during the relationship. there's an equal or a presumption of that both parties will be entitled to equal value regardless of whose name the house is in or the mortgage is in. So once you bring a house into marriage, it gets, you know, your spouse is presumed to have half of that value as it applies to the net family property calculation, remember? And there's also a presumption of sort of equal possession upon separation. So you may hear that, you know, you're not supposed to change the locks when you separate from your husband or wife. That's absolutely the case because they have just, regardless of who's on title, they have just as much a right to be there as the other. It, of course, there's exceptions if there's a case of safety, and usually the courts are involved if that's the case, but there's definitely special significance to the matrimonial home.
So him just really ticking me off isn't enough to change the locks. That was what you're saying, right?
Generally not, right? You have to, again, have a pretty extreme situation. So I don't recommend it. So that's the situation when you're married and you separate. And I should also say that if your spouse, if your spouse dies, or I suppose either way, in the unfortunate event, and either of you doesn't have a will, then you would have, under the Succession Law Reform Act, a claim to the estate. That's pretty straightforward if you're a spouse. But this isn't the case if you are common law spouses. And that sort of leads me to, okay, what's the situation for common law spouses? It's very different. So there's no legislative entitlement, no net family property division.
No matter how long you've been common laws, I know a lot of couples who've lived together for 15 years, they've never been married.
Exactly. And I should say, so that there's no legislative entitlement. So there's no law that sets out there's net family property division or special status for the matrimonial home or any of those other benefits. And there's also similar to the, or sort of reflective of how the sort of estate law goes for married spouses, there's no automatic claim for a common law spouse if their partner dies without a will, or can be very difficult to establish any kind of claim at all. So overwhelmingly, this seems unfair, right? If I'm living with someone, it's just the same. And there's also, I mean, when you keep in mind, there's a lot of reasons why people don't get married, especially these days. I mean, if it's not, they don't have religious significance to it, they, you know, would rather spend the money on a down payment for a home or something like that. And especially if they think it's going to be the same anyway for common law, right?
Yeah. But, and I also, you know, you brought up the case of folks passing away, and it's reminding me, you know, a lot of people older, later in life, get into relationships. Mm-hmm. And especially, you know, I know a relationship it made me think of is that, you know, the partner taking care of this person in, you know, sickness and health, even though they weren't mm-hmm. married. And then, you know, at the time of that person's passing, you know, they were kind of set out in the cold because the family, you know, didn't acknowledge, they didn't have anything in writing saying that they had any, you know, they had moved into the home, which belonged then to the family as opposed to belonging to this person who, you know, used later years in their life to care for someone in their ending days. So yeah, exactly. it seems really unfair, and you can just, you know, especially a person like that, that's a vulnerable population, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you see too, with a lot of younger people, if, you know, younger people tend to not think to make a will, right? Or at least less so the younger you are. And if there's an unfortunate accident and you're living with someone for a long time, you think that they're going to get the benefit of it. Why bother make a will? That's not the case, right? So it is very different with respect to property. But there are some remedies in law. Like I said, there's no legislative entitlement to net family property division, for example, but the courts have addressed this, especially given that more and more people are choosing to live in common law relationships as opposed to getting married. So there are remedies available that have been established in the case law, but they're very remedial in nature. They're going to remedy or correct for something that rises to the level of being unjust or using the unjust enrichment principle. So you really, instead of where spouses who are married upon separation have this presumption of equal entitlement, they both contributed equally and all of their contributions are valid, financial or not, you really, if you're in a common law relationship and you want to have access to any sort of remedy for contributions, you said, for example, to the home that you share, you have to prove it. And you have to show that you were really, you know, that you're out this money. It can't be that or at least it's very, and it often applies to just specific properties as opposed to an overall division of all the assets. So these remedies, I mean, they've been sort of, you know, the basic concept, as I said, is unjust enrichment. So you have to show one partner gets a benefit. So example, equity in the home, right, that they didn't have before the relationship, a corresponding deprivation from the other partner. So again, a common example, they paid those mortgage payments to contribute to the increase in equity. And then you also have to have an absence of a juristic reason. So this could be, you know, if you have an agreement that says, no, we're going to come to some arrangement about the home that isn't just splitting it 50-50, that would be, I mean, you can't really make a claim then that says it's unfair if you have a separation or a legally binding document that says that was your arrangement. The courts, again, have fine-tuned this concept somewhat. There's something called a joint family venture in common law now that sort of clarifies the test for unjust enrichment as it applies in the family context. So there's an overall, what the court looks at overall there, again, if there exists an unjust, and I'm reading here because it is very technical, if there exists an unjust retention of an inappropriately disproportionate share of assets accumulated during a relationship that is a joint family venture to which both have contributed. So again, it's unjust retention. There has to be this imbalance. So the court will look at whether there is mutual effort put in. So if you decided to raise kids together, if you have joint bank accounts, that kind of thing, the level of economic integration. So again, joint bank accounts would qualify as that, shared expenses, that kind of thing, whether you had an intention to integrate. So that can be often established from conduct, right? Again, these joint bank accounts are really helpful if you want to show that you really intended to work together as in this joint venture sort of sense. And then if a spouse, or sorry, a common law spouse, I should say, had suffered a detriment as a result of making the family a priority. So if you could have had this great job across the country, but your spouse and kids are here, those kind of sacrifices, or, you know, taking time off work is another common one. So if this is established, the court can award a monetary, remedy. So, and this is usually proportionate to what you put in. So if you say I made, you know, $50,000 in payments towards the mortgage, it would be proportionate to that. It wouldn't just be splitting the house as a default. The court really looks at making it proportionate. And if that doesn't remedy the situation, you can have a situation where a trust is established and you have an ownership in a property or an asset, even though you're not on title. But these are they're technical, they're very resource intensive if you end up going to court, and it's a case by case basis. It really gets, frankly, expensive if you litigate this because you're looking at bank records. If it's a long relationship, that works out really well for your claim on one hand, but you often can't get records back that far. So if you're saying, you know, you live together for 10 years, a bank often is going to say, well, that's fine. I don't have the records for you though. So it can be very difficult to prove. It's very difficult to predict how some of these cases turn out. Very expensive and just fuels that animosity that you were talking about upon separation.
Yeah, not a lot of good feelings when a breakup happens either way. And
exactly.
Yeah, it's only going to be kindling on the fire. I went to get some records at the bank and I think it gets 6 months or something, right? Because everything's digital,
exactly.
Right? Everything's digital now and you're not printing it out and putting it in a filing cabinet. We're all trying to save the planet. So it's all about, you know, and when you're in a relationship, whether it's a marriage or common law, we're not thinking about the end game, right? You love this person. You're having a great time. You're in love. It's well, ups and downs, whatever. But when the end comes, it feels like you deal with this all the time. So I'm sure, you know, you're a little more cynical in your relationships or your relationships and your personal lives, you know, advising people. So what can we do? Is there something to think about, you know, before that time comes to protect ourselves? As opposed,
absolutely.
Because if people don't want to get married, some people just don't, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it is a deeply personal choice. Like there are a lot of reasons why people don't want to you know, make that decision or you know, go down that road of marriage for sure. So the best way to protect yourself and to ensure that there's no surprises or unintended consequences in the event that you separate is to do a domestic contract. These can be done at any time. You don't have to worry about getting one in place before you move in together or even before you get married. They can be, a domestic contract can be done at any point. And this really will save you in the event that you separate a lot down the road. And if you think about it, I know it's, like you say, it's unpleasant to think about. There's this sort of stigma or connotation that, well, if you want me to sign a prenup, which is, you know, sort of American lingo there, but that means you don't, you know, you're not really committed, right? Or people want to, you know, they get understandably romantic about the idea, and it seems in poor taste to go through the exercise of doing these agreements. But if you look at it like insurance, nobody buys insurance for their home hoping it'll burn down, right? But in the event that it does, we want to make sure that, you know, it's we minimize the financial and just emotional damage on you if in the unlikely and hopefully non-event that this happens in the future. So that is really the best way to, especially if you don't take that step to get married, and even if you do and you want to protect certain assets. So it works for both situations. And really the time to come to those agreements is when you're getting along, right? Not when you're fighting about it and really upset with each other.
Bring it up like Sunday morning at breakfast. It's not like a Saturday night, Friday night kind of conversation.
Exactly.
you mentioned you can do it after the relationship has already started. What kind of language is in there? Do you go back to the beginning? How does that work?
Yeah, and you can have different, you can have agreements that contemplate marriage as well. You can have, you know, okay, we live together now, but if we get married, you know, XYZ, if we don't, you know, or if things continue, we'll, you know, there'll be these terms. So usually, I mean, it'll cover, the financial side of things. It's, you can't really put into, or you can't rely, I should say, you can't reliably put into an agreement terms to do with children and childcare, just because the test is best interest of the children. That's not always foreseeable, right? So usually you can't put the terms related to children in an agreement, or if you do, they might not be binding down the road if the situation changes. But with the financial, the financial sort of issues, certainly what we often see is a spousal support release, for example. You know, we agree that no matter what, we are independent of each other and we won't be seeking spousal support. So that's something that it's something people often think like, oh yeah, I wouldn't go after spousal support. Well, if that's the case, then you might want to make sure before, you know, in the event, I shouldn't say before, because it's certainly not inevitable, but in case things are not mutually understood or the opinion changes upon separation.
All right. Well, that's great advice. This has been so educational. And I know that you at Lancaster Town and Wilch can help with those kinds of contracts and so much more. Dana, fantastic first appearance on Legal Matters. Well, I hope you'll come back again sometime.
I would be delighted. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Dana. And thank you so much for listening. This has been Legal Matters, Lancaster, Chown, and Welch. We'll be back with you in a couple of weeks. I'm your host, Steph Vivier. Have a great night.